Welcome to Bruderhof Radio, a bi-monthly program broadening the bounds of discourse on progressive thought and action. I'm your host, Andrew Zimmerman. Never before in the history of the world have so many people been incarcerated under one flag. This year, the United States prison population exceeded 2 million, with increasing numbers serving time for nonviolent drug-related offenses. But while politicians strive to be tough on crime, funding for programs that are truly rehabilitative has been on the decline. Today's so-called correctional facilities are focused more on warehousing humans than on any kind of corrective action. And with higher and higher rates of recidivism, things will probably get much worse before there is a decision to overhaul the system. Still, it didn't always used to be that way. At its inception, the typical State Department of Corrections was an institution committed to producing changed people. And even today, in the small number of facilities still permitting some form of rehabilitation, the success of these efforts remains high. Bruderhof Radio presents one such program in a special hour-long documentary, coming up next. For the past 18 years, approximately 15 inmates from across New York State have transferred to the infamous Sing Sing prison for a year of intensive study administered by the Manhattan-based New York Theological Seminary. Upon completing the coursework, the inmates receive a Master's of Professional Studies, equivalent to 1 year of traditional theological seminary. To find out more about the program, Bruderhof Radio traveled to Sing Sing, where we met with participants in this year's master's degree class. Today, we'll hear them discuss how the program started and how participation in the program affects their relations with other inmates and prison staff. Although by no means novel or unique, the opinions expressed are significant because they come, so to speak, from the belly of the beast. Bill Weber, a professor at New York Theological Seminary, has been the program's director for 18 years. He describes how it was founded amid the turbulence following the 1972 prison riots in Attica, New York.
After Attica, which was a terrible event in New York State, when the prison men rolled in the prison and they sent in the state troopers and there were a number of deaths, led the public, the press, and others to say, we've got to find out what's going on in our prison system. And the governor then and the department made a major commitment to be a correction system, to offer any inmate that wanted a chance to turn his life around by providing education programs, substance abuse programs. And colleges discovered they could come in and offer college degrees to an inmate who had a GED. And this was paid for by federal Pell Grants. So that what happened was in 5 or 10 years, a number of inmates who had really turned their lives around and made use of that still had time in their sentences, and they got together with a chaplain and said, we've got to do some more graduate, we've got to do some study, we've got to have a graduate degree. And since many of them were in his faith community, they came to New York Seminary and said, Bill, do you know there are 100 men or more in the state system, maybe 300 or 400, who have a college degree, and they're dying to get some more education. You've got to do a graduate degree program for them. And we said, quite simply, that's what New York Seminary exists to do. We can respond, but you'll never get permission from the Department of Correction to have a Protestant seminary offer a master's program in state prisons. He said, that's my problem. What I didn't know was that after Attica, in order to get African-American and Hispanic chaplains who are relevant to the inmates in the prison system for the first time, mm-hmm. and to help make it a better ministerial program, they'd hired an African-American pastor from Harlem to be the assistant commissioner to develop it. And he was just waiting in Albany to be made famous by starting the first master's program in a prison. So with great cooperation, the system agreed that they would transfer every year 15 men from all over the state, whom we selected, to Sing Sing for an intensive graduate year, with the understanding that the inmates then would commit themselves, in return for a year of free education and a master's degree, to help other inmates as long as they were in prison. That's how it got started. And we're now, and it was fascinating because the statistics indicate that if an inmate, man or woman, managed to get a college degree in prison, it cut the recidivism rate in half. So with the federal government paying the cost of tuition, it was saving the government of New York State maybe as much as $100,000 or more for every inmate that got it in recidivism costs over the long haul. And then if you took our master's program on top of it, it meant that something like 6%, it cut that recidivism rate almost down to nothing, because this gives men credentials when they get out mm-hmm. to get a job. We have been blessed by the system in allowing the inmates to be full-time assigned to our care. Whereas you go to college, you work two morning or afternoon, go to college at night. In this case, they're totally responsible for us. So what they do is they're transferred here from all over the state, the 16 or 17 men we want. They go to school every morning from 9 to 12, and we send in top-notch faculty. There, it's not an adjunct faculty. This is just a classroom in New York Seminary, 30 miles up the Hudson. And they get a 42-credit degree. Then in the afternoon or evening, they are assigned to supervise ministry, where they're involved in work with other inmates, pre-release clerks, doing substance abuse programs. They're involved in developing their own skills in ministry, and then they have either afternoon or evening free with a fine library in the study hall that we provide. So that it's quite unusual to have a program where we can take these men and have them fully involved in our program for this academic year, which makes it a very powerful impact. Because we're much concerned that they continue to mature as human beings, develop their own sense of identity and faith commitments, and develop their skills that they can use when they get out, as we are that they learn something in the head. The result of this is that the state government, a year ago now, gave the seminary a great deal of money to use our alumni who are out as youth workers, as workers with youth at risk in Harlem, East Harlem, and Bed-Stuy. And it's a remarkable program. It was initially called Youth at Risk, using these graduates as wonderful role models, terrific opportunity for them. Though recently the youth have demanded they change the name because they say we're not youth at risk now, so it's called Youth Turn. But it indicates the value of our graduates to society.
The 17 men who graduated with master's degrees this June came across as thoughtful, eloquent, focused, and well-read. They have waited anywhere from 2 to 5 years to be accepted in the program, having already obtained bachelor's degrees elsewhere in the prison system. Most are serving long sentences of 10 to 20 years. But as George, a program participant, hurries to point out, the advantages of being a model prisoner are not always clearly to be felt.
The general population do not actually agree with the program, or they see us as being different than them, or they may think that we feel that we're different than them. So we're being attacked in that sense. The administration throws obstacles in our way, so we have to constantly encourage each other to keep on with the struggle to go through the program.
My name is Aishan, and to kind of dovetail on what George was saying about the guys in the general population, there is a degree of envy, but there's also a degree of admiration from some of our fellow inmates. Many of them look up to us for having gone through the academic steps to get to this point. Many of them do not understand what it takes to get to this point, and therefore, through their lack of understanding, they may express some enmity toward us. But basically and essentially, even the ones who do not express the admiration, I think that they secretly admire what we do. Part of this program entails a year of pastoral counseling as well as the other academic work that we do. And within the context of pastoral counseling, we are taught to administer to everyone in every occasion, in any way that we possibly can. And based upon the nature of the facility and the nature of the ignorance and the psychological, you know, depression within the context of the facility, we end up doing a lot of administering to our fellow inmates. We have another aspect to the program that is called a field study. What the field study entails, basically, is anywhere, any part of the facility that has a program that is service-oriented, for example, ASAT, ART, these are programs that deal with nonviolence or drug abuse or AIDS awareness or any other kind of programs, including religious programs such as the Protestant chapel or the Catholic chapel or the pre-release center that needs qualified people to explain things to the inmate population, to interact with the inmate population on as many levels as possible, we literally sign a contract that for the duration of the semesters, the two semesters that we're here, we would serve on a voluntary basis at least three times a week within the context of that program. And it's actually an accredited part of the Masters of Professional Study. So in addition to the academic work that we're doing, we're literally doing hands-on work with people to show what it is exactly that we're learning within the context of the program. And that kind of give us the practical experience that we need. Even though many of us here came from other facilities where we were involved in practical work. See, so it's not as if we really needed, a lot of us needed to do that work, but that work also show and prove that the work that we're doing can be applied on a practical level as well.
Yet despite the fact that program participants do significant counseling work both at Sing Sing and after returning to their respective facilities, the lack of support from prison guards and staff is often noticeable. Aishan thinks this may have to do with their own lack of opportunity.
Well, like the inmate population, there's mixed feelings among the administration as well. I've been locked up 22 years. And from that experience within the context of the prison environment, I've learned that there are many administrative personnel who secretly admire what it is that we do. But because of the nature of the system being anti-prisoners, a lot of them choose not to express that. And so they will, on the surface, show an open antagonism toward us, where secretly they'll admire what we do. And then there are those who openly and oppose what we're doing and are openly antagonistic towards what we're doing because they perceive what we're doing as a future threat to their own jobs. And job security is everything when you get a job in the Department of Correctional Services. You know, many of them perceive us as somehow down the road, being more or overqualified or much more qualified than them. I mean, let's face it. A master's degree is nothing to sniff at. So upon our release, within the context of the job market out there, we'll be pretty much more capable and more qualified than they are, many of them. Many of them couldn't get a job anywhere else, so this is it for them. And here it is, they have to come to work every day and look at a guy getting a master's degree. You know, who the hell does he think he is, you know? And so they may perceive that as us thinking that we're better than them, when in fact all we're doing is trying to better our conditions, and giving ourselves a better chance to go out there and to survive in the great big world. Because, you know, a guy with a felony under his belt, you know, he's got a lot to go up against when he get out of here.
You're listening to Ritterhoff Radio. We're speaking with participants in the Masters of Professional Studies program at Sing Sing Correctional Facility in Ossining, New York. Unfortunately, Bill Weber's assertions of lowered recidivism and the fieldwork done by program participants was not enough to discourage lawmakers from eliminating federal funding for higher education in prisons. In 1994, all bachelor's degree programs in New York State prisons were discontinued. As a result, Weber is now seeing a reduction in the number of applicants to his program because fewer and fewer inmates have the prerequisite educational background. He blames this turn of events on tough-on-crime politicians who are more interested in winning elections than in solving society's real problems.
That was a real tragedy, and many people in the system knew that. For example, the superintendent at Sing Sing was horrified because when you have a college program, it means that thousands of men in the whole system and women behave and study and work because they'd like to get there. You see, it's a tremendous factor for the peace and viability of the institutions. So he actually called me in and said, "Bill, I got to have men with nothing to do when they kill the college program. Can't you use your graduates to teach other inmates to help fulfill the gap by post-GED year," which we've been willing to do. So that, but the part of the problem is you've got to face the fact that if you're an officer in the prison, and you have a GED, and you're getting along on a salary, but you've got kids going to college, it's very painful to think that inmates are being allowed to get a free college and graduate degree. That's a very painful thing to think, and now there are plenty of them do that, but it's still, and then on the outside, for the society to think, my God, men and women who go to prison are being able to get a free college degree, that's really not being tough on crime, that's pretty ridiculous. That's how federal government could kill it without it being questioned so heavily, and why it's been able to happen. Even though, from the point of view of New York State, it's fiscally stupid, yet you got to maintain this image, we're being tough on crime. And as you've already heard, there's a far better way to deal with the problems of drugs in our society than to put small-time drug people in prison for 15 years to life sentences. I mean, the whole thing is just a real tragedy that's there. But this image that the people we're putting in prison today are all evil, vicious human beings that have got to be put aside to protect society is a tragic myth that is very difficult to shatter or challenge. But as you could discover, the men you've talked to here and you've met elsewhere, it is a tragedy for so many of these people. And in a way, it's not when you put a woman in prison, you're punishing, for no fault of their own, probably five more people or an inmate. You're punishing their father and mother and their kids and their wives or husband. I mean, it's not just the inmate, but it's a whole group of people that are suffering from this solution to the problem in half the cases in prison or more of our inabilities as a society to deal effectively with drugs.
The longer we talked with the men of Sing Sing, the more we felt their particular frustration with the whole system of criminal justice. Seen as it was from their unique vantage point, and vulnerable as they are to its every text and subtext, the shift underway from a system of correction to one of punishment is painfully clear. To them, it is every bit the prison industrial complex, a kind of monster bent on feeding itself with no apparent interest in supporting programs that enable men to escape its grasp. Herb, another participant, explains.
You have guys going out of here that are going into communities, they're creating programs, they're changing the lives of people, they're influencing, they're making a difference with the youth, they're making a difference in the churches, they're making a difference in the political, the economic, and the social arena outside. Inside, guys like us keep a lot of, we bring reason and calmness to certain situations that could turn explosive inside the prison. And what they're doing right now, this program is under attack by the administration. And it seems to me, it's what it says to me, that they're doing everything they can to keep people from becoming empowered and educated and being released from these jails. Because it's a proven fact that this program has the lowest rate of recidivism of any program of any class or category of people in the state. All right, and the higher it's also a proven fact that the higher the educational level of people, the lower the recidivism rate. So what it tells me is that they took away the college programs. So it seems a purposeful plot to keep people in jails, because they're taking away the programs that would keep people in the street, that allow for the least recidivism and the guys that's going to go out and do the best good in the community.
Whether or not official statistics would support these allegations, it seemed clear that most of the men in this particular program had been denied parole routinely. Aishan says that while he and his fellow students may not be specifically targeted, it is clear that, in general, the New York Department of Corrections is wary of efforts to rehabilitate.
In this context, as a religious circle, a supposedly religious circle, we find it even harder because almost everybody here is from a different faith belief. Okay, you have Protestants, you have Catholics, you have Muslims. You have people that really don't believe in anything. And you have myself, I don't belong to any faith community, even though I believe in God. Okay, so you're going to find a wide variety of differences between the individuals here. However, we're all prisoners. and we're all prisoners that are striving to make our lives better and to increase our chances of success out there beyond the wall. The parole board knows this. The administration knows this. Albany knows this. The inmate population knows this. Everybody knows this. And when we go to the board, we still get hit because of the political atmosphere. Getting hit means getting at least 2 years added to your time where you see the board again. You know, come back and see us in 2 years. But again, I don't want you leaving here thinking that we all consider ourselves, you know, smelling like roses, because we don't. We know we have done some bad things. We know we have given ammunition to the politicians that they're using against us, okay, to rack up the statistics and say, well, look at what these guys did and look at what these guys... Yeah, we know that. We understand that very well. But we also understand that we come from communities that are being sucked dry by those same politicians. We also understand that the level of poverty that exists in those communities from which we came are the things, the generative factors that allow so many of us from those same communities to come here to begin with. So while we know that, yes, we played a part in it, we also understand that a man who does not control his own environment has no control over his destiny. And we certainly did not have any control over our environment. Our environments are controlled by forces outside of our environment. The stores, the guns, the liquor stores, the drugs, none of those things are created in our environment. None of those things are created in those communities. There are no gun factories. There are no alcohol factories. There are no drug factories in those communities. But guess where all the guns and alcohol and other products from those factories end up? Right there. They sell them there more than they sell them anywhere else. And because they sell them there more than they sell them anyplace else, the victims and the people who use them are going to come from that environment more than anywhere else. And it seemed like one situation is serving another. For example, if a hospital didn't have patients, it wouldn't exist. There wouldn't be any need for it. So if there wasn't any crime-generative factor, you wouldn't have any need for the cops. You wouldn't have any need for the court system. You wouldn't have any need for the Department of Correctional Service. One service exists to serve the other. And together, they all make up a system that serve each other and just continue to bleed the communities dry.
According to one inmate in Kosi, the Department of Corrections has so much interest in keeping the system running that undue media coverage and journalistic interest are actively avoided.
I think it's important to say all of the things that are being said, and I'm not even sure if you're aware of just what it is at stake. And I say that to say this. While all of those things are important that we're saying about the system and DOC and Department of Corrections, et cetera, you only come in here and are able to do what you're doing now in terms of these interviews by their goodwill. Right. Once someone in the Department of Corrections hears this tape, you won't be coming in anymore. So I think it's important to go in with your eyes open, knowing that that's what's at stake. So in all fairness, I thought it was important because if you talk to prisoners, particularly when you look around the classroom and there are guys here who have 20 years and 22 years of being incarcerated, that's 22 years of being in the belly of the beast and catching hell and trying to maintain our sanity. And when you go around the room and you put the microphone in front of us and we articulate these issues, that comes out as pain and struggle of all of those years of trying to remain sane. But it's important that you understand that the Department of Corrections does not want the public to hear about the issues, the real issues of incarceration, the real issues of crime generative factors. They don't want the public to hear about that. They're satisfied with the public getting the spiel from their public relations person. And then that way a nice spiel could put on it and they could further justify the high levels of incarcerations among blacks and Latinos.
Even with the possibility of retaliation, we found the men of Sing Sing more than willing to express their thoughts and feelings toward the prison system. It was as if they saw in us the opportunity to communicate with the outside world just what is happening inside the belly of the beast.
This class that you're visiting today, we're very uninhibited. We'll talk about anything at any time, and we'll even initiate the discussion. But the problem is, particularly, and we've learned because we have suffered some of the brunt of the angst of DOC as a result of some of the papers that we've written throughout the year, and the last year's students have suffered as well from a document called the Cairo Statement. And primarily what that is it's a document that master's degree students talk about the context in which we're living in. In other words, we speak truth to power. We talk about some of the things that are going on inside of the Department of Corrections that are not being spoken about by the Department of Corrections. And because we are the voiceless, the prisoners, we are the voiceless. No one hears us. And most people, because they have been fed a bill of goods, don't want to hear us. And quite often when we tell them about the criminality of correction officers and the unjust practices that's instituted inside prisons throughout the state, 9 times out of 10, they do not believe us. So we're the voiceless, and what this does, and we're so very appreciative, what this does for us is it gives us a voice to speak truth to power and to say some things, and we hope that the things that we say will not just fall on deaf ears, but that someone hearing the things will at least attempt to come and try to rectify what's being going on. We don't want to just blow hot air. That's not what we want to do. So we appreciate you coming. We hope you will be able to come back. We're not optimistic that that'll happen once news gets out of what took place here today.
You've been listening to Bruderhof Radio, a special report on the prison industrial complex. Please join us again for the second half of this program as we continue speaking with participants in the Masters of Professional Studies program at Sing Sing Correctional Facility in Ossining, New York. This program was produced by Andrew Zimmerman and Ben Wright. Special thanks to Fred Mao for additional reporting. Bruderhof Radio is a production of the Bruderhof Communities, a communal movement based on Christ's Sermon on the Mount, in particular the teachings concerning brotherly love and love of enemies, mutual service, nonviolence, and the refusal to bear arms. Money and possessions are pooled voluntarily, and in turn each member is provided for and cared for. For more information about the Bruderhof Communities and Bruderhof Radio, call 1-800-778-8461. Again, that's 1-800-778-8461.